Hi, Marco Werman here. Looking back on 2023, I'm so proud of the work our team has produced. It's always an honor to share this work and these stories with you. As we present the voices of the people behind the headlines, we do so with our listeners, with you in mind. And as we highlight the bright spots in our reporting, we think of you and hope that, as our listener Cameron said so well, they remind you that there is a full spectrum of experiences, feelings, and intentions on this planet. We work to ensure that listeners have a better, more empathetic understanding of our world beyond borders. So now it's our turn to look to you. As the end of the year approaches, so does the end of our fundraising drive. December 31st is our deadline, but we are still short of our fundraising goal. Our nonprofit newsroom depends on listeners like you, and every listener gift makes a difference. A generous donor has set a challenge match for us to increase the impact of each gift. If we raise $67,000 by December 31st, each donation will be matched one for one. I hope you'll donate today so we can continue to bring you the global news you rely on. Visit theworld.org/give to donate today. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much. Thailand takes a big step toward legalizing same-sex marriage. Advocates for the change say that after a 10-year campaign, it's about time.
We have been trying to push this forward more than a decade, so we consider it is slow.
I'm Marco Werman. After 11 weeks of war in the Gaza Strip, life for people there is about what they don't have.
No electricity, no potable water, no cooking gas. And I think we are back in the Stone Age there in Gaza.
Also, why families in Peru with sick children are looking elsewhere for medical treatment. And in Britain, many young people are giving up on organized religion. Not so with Islam, one of the fastest growing faiths in the UK.
There are values in being British and values from our faith that actually they're harmonious.
All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us today. Day 76 of war between Hamas and Israel. The Israel Defense Forces continued with airstrikes on the Gaza Strip today as Hamas fired more rockets at Israel. Meanwhile, there are diplomatic efforts underway to find a way to halt the fighting. Ismail Haniyeh, one of the top political leaders from Hamas, is in Egypt's capital, Cairo, to negotiate a possible truce. And in New York, the United Nations Security Council is still working on a resolution for a ceasefire and humanitarian relief for people in Gaza. Mekhaymer Abousada is a professor of political science at Al-Azhar University in Gaza. He recently left the Palestinian territory and joins us from Cairo. I want to ask you, Mekhaymer, about these negotiations toward a possible ceasefire going on in Cairo, but I'm also very curious about your journey out of the Gaza Strip and into Egypt. What was that like?
Well, I evacuated Gaza with my family about a month ago. My elder two sons are American citizens, and because of that, we were eligible to evacuate the Gaza Strip with my family, but unfortunately, one of my sons wasn't eligible for evacuation, and he is still stuck in Gaza up until this moment. According to American rules, any siblings who are above the age of 21 aren't eligible for evacuation, and this is a very painful thing that we have been dealing with this for the past month now. I lived in Gaza for 42 days during this current war with my family. It was a very painful experience.
Is there one scene that for you really illustrates the misery for people inside Gaza right now? Like, what's the memory that you kind of bring with you into Egypt?
Well, I have to say that in one incident, there was an Israeli bombing that hit not very far away from where I was staying, no more than 20 meters. For a moment, I felt that the bombing was above our heads, and one of the shrapnel hit one of my nephews who was staying with us in the same room at that time. That was really a very scary situation. Women were crying, kids were screaming. The intensity of the bombing wasn't really very far away from where we were in Khan Yunis, and that was the closest that we almost got injured or killed by that incident.
Now that you're on the other side of the wall in Egypt, what do you think needs to happen in the short term to address the humanitarian crisis in Gaza?
An immediate thing that is needed to be done now, even before then tomorrow, is a ceasefire. That's what 2.3 million people in Gaza want now. A ceasefire, whether it's a limited truce like the one we witnessed 3 weeks ago at the end of November, or a permanent one. I have to say that Palestinians in Gaza are very exhausted, very tired. I see people appealing on TV, appealing for the world, appealing for the Arab Islamic world, for the international community to impose a ceasefire on both Hamas and Israel, because it's the Palestinian civilian population who are paying the price of this war.
Mekheimer, let's talk about the diplomatic efforts underway where you are now in Egypt. With the Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh in Cairo, what is the goal? What is Hamas trying to accomplish?
Hamas has been saying for the past 3 weeks that they will not accept an interim ceasefire, that they want an end to the war, they want an end to the current fighting, and they want a permanent ceasefire, and they are willing to release all Israeli prisoners or hostages under the rule all for all, meaning releasing all Israeli hostages in exchange of releasing all Palestinian prisoners. We're talking about 5,000 Palestinian prisoners who were inside Israeli jails before the 7th of October, and the number have risen roughly to 10,000 now as a result of arresting roughly 4,000 Palestinians from the West Bank and 1,000 from the Gaza Strip over the past 76 days.
Do you think that's a realistic goal?
One of the goals of Prime Minister Netanyahu is to stay in power, to stay in office. And even if there's going to be an early elections in Israel, he definitely wants to make sure that he is re-elected for another term. And under those circumstances, I find it difficult for Netanyahu to accept that deal. So I think what the Egyptians are trying to do now is broker another temporary ceasefire.
What's it been like being in Egypt, watching this devastating conflict play out in the Gaza Strip?
Well, I have to say, I spend most of my time watching TV, watching the news. That's basically what I'm doing. But other than that, talk to my relatives, talk to my son in Gaza on a daily basis.
And what are you hearing right now from Gaza, from your son?
Marco, I don't even know how to explain this. It's been 76 days now. No electricity, no potable water, no cooking gas. And I think we are back in the Stone Age there in Gaza. People are using woods and fire to bake and to cook. They're basically walking long distances to try to find potable water. Prices are like 10 times the original price of goods and commodities. The situation is much, much more dire now after 76 days of war. The inability to allow humanitarian assistance to get into the Gaza Strip. It's just becoming beyond imagination, to be honest with you.
Mekheimer Abu Saada is an associate professor of political science at Al-Azhar University in Gaza. He joined us from Cairo, Egypt. Thank you very much indeed for your time. Take care, Mekheimer.
Thanks very much, Marco.
A federal court in Australia has slapped a $10 million fine on Airbnb for overcharging its customers over a span of 3 years. The company will also have to pay compensation to victims, 63,000 of them. From Sydney, The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
For 3.5 years, between 2018 and 2021, Airbnb was displaying prices in U.S. dollars instead of Australian dollars, even though the customers were in Australia. Both the U.S. and Australia used the dollar sign. But at the time, the Australian dollar was worth about 72 cents U.S., so a customer who thought they were paying $500 for a place to stay was actually paying almost $700. Australia's Consumer Protection Agency, the ACCC, filed the lawsuit. The chairperson, Gina Cass-Gottlieb, spoke to Australian Television 7 News on Wednesday.
When Australian consumers go on an Australian website to book Australian accommodation, it is reasonable that when they see a dollar symbol, that they read it and understand it to be Australian dollars.
A federal court justice found Airbnb's conduct was, quote, misleading and deceptive. Not all Australian customers were affected, and about 2,000 customers ended up complaining to Airbnb over the years. The company told some of them it was their fault because they had selected the American currency option, which wasn't true, said the court. Later on, the company blamed a software bug that failed to default customers in Australia to the local currency. The federal judge wrote in his decision that Airbnb didn't set out to mislead consumers. But Joe Uchukolo, a consumer advocate in Brisbane, says the board knew about this issue as far back as 2018 and chose not to do anything about it. So did they do it on purpose?
Well, look, as someone who is in charge of software, I wouldn't let a bug go for 3 years for something that was so important. And I wonder if this bug would have hung around for 3 years had it been to the detriment of Airbnb's revenue to the total of $16.8 million.
Which is how much they made by overcharging customers. This isn't the first time Airbnb has run afoul of Australian regulators. In 2015, the company got in trouble for a practice known as drip pricing, which is where they advertise one price for the property at the beginning of the booking process and then gradually add on fees so you end up paying more at checkout. That time, they got away with a slap on the wrist. This time, they must pay a fine of $15 million Australian, or about $10 million American, and on top of that, another $15 million to compensate customers. Airbnb said in a statement that while only a very small percentage of Australian consumers were impacted, the company would like to apologize. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum in Sydney.
Christmas tree decorations are unique to each tree, adorned with treasure special to that family. At the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library and Museum in Simi Valley, California, Christmas trees are on display with an international twist. KCLU's Caroline Faraday has our story.
Twenty-six uniquely decorated Christmas trees are twinkling with lights at the Reagan Library, each tree representing a different country.
So each one has the motif and some of the traditions of those countries, and there are some you can recognize straight away, and you say, oh, this must be this country, and sure enough it is, and then others you have to do a little detective work. And again, all of these trees represent the 26 countries President Reagan visited while he was in office.
Laurie Wollstonecroft Cook from the Reagan Presidential Library shows me around.
So, yeah, Switzerland and Canada, and down here we have our neighbors to the south, Mexico.
From the snowy crystals of the Nordic countries to an all-white adorned tree for the Vatican, the trees are very festive, but also a reminder of the history between the United States and each country, from Switzerland to Russia and China.
And one of his most famous visits was with Pope John Paul II, and then this is the tree that they've chosen to represent Italy, and he had a very special relationship with Pope John Paul II.
Reagan and Gorbachev in Red Square.
Yes, it's just a historic photo, especially in light of recent decades. Costa Rica, very colorful, vibrant, oranges and yellows.
Guess which one I'm waiting for?
This one, I think. Why do I think it's this one? Am I right? England.
Families here today seem to be delighted by the display.
Oh, they're lovely.
What do you make of them?
I love how they're each individual to the countries, and I love the layout and how they took the time with the ornaments to try to figure out and make an association with the country. So we started at the very end to try to guess. We wanted to guess where the trees were from, so we didn't see the markers first, but they're beautiful. We came here just for the trees.
Oh, they're beautiful. We love the Christmas trees at the Reagan Library, and it's nice to see the presidential pictures with each one, with a description.
I think they're pretty nice. I like the blue ones more.
This is Spain. I like the flamenco. Now, I like the flamenco dancers. Those are fun. Okay, flamenco dancers are fun. That is cute. I do like that. Yeah. Oh, this is at Windsor Castle. So this is English. I don't see no fish and chips on that tree.
That is an omission. I agree.
Yeah, see? Right.
Bangers and mash.
Okay, teapots. Yeah, we got that. We got the buses, you know. The clock there, the Big Ben.
There's also a Gold Star Family Memorial Tree where Gold Star families are encouraged to add an ornament of their loved one. The Christmas Around the World exhibit runs until January 7th at the Reagan Library. For The World, I'm Caroline Faraday in Simi Valley, California.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. 10 Americans held in detention by Venezuela were able to return to the U.S. on Wednesday. In exchange, the United States freed a close ally of Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro. His name is Alex Saab. According to a federal indictment, Saab was a crucial player in laundering public money for Maduro's government. Jeff Ramsey is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, where he's focused on foreign policy in Latin America. We reached him in Colombia. Jeff, the 10 released Americans had been arrested or held in Venezuela on an array of different charges. Tell us more about who these Americans are.
That's right. So this is a mix of 6 Americans who the U.S. determined to be wrongfully detained in Venezuela, as well as 4 other Americans, which the Maduro regime had accused of taking part in coup attempts against it. But what this means is that Venezuela is now free of American prisoners. This is a huge deal for an administration that's been working hard to release wrongfully detained Americans across the world.
Venezuela also released 20 of their own prisoners. Do we know what kind of charges they were being held on?
That's right. We saw the release of 20 Venezuelan political prisoners, all of whom faced charges ranging from insurrection to participating in coup attempts as well. These are Venezuelans who, by and large, are recognized by leading human rights groups in the country as wrongfully detained as well, and many of them are considered prisoners of conscience by organizations like Amnesty International.
So this key ally of Maduro's named Alex Saab, jailed in the U.S. but released in exchange for 10 Americans and 20 Venezuelans in their jails. Tell us more about Alex Saab. I mean, Maduro referred to him as a diplomat. Who is he?
So Alex Saab is actually a Colombian national who, for most of Maduro's early years in power, helped him evade sanctions. He's been associated with different money laundering fronts for the Venezuelan government. He's sort of seen as a bagman for the Maduro government. The Maduro government has been insisting on his release for years. In fact, they've pointed to his ongoing detention in the United States as a key reason for dragging their feet in ongoing negotiations with Washington over elections next year.
I mean, there's this constant back and forth and tension when it comes to prisoner exchanges. How much do you worry about detainees essentially becoming bargaining chips? In other words, do swaps just encourage foreign governments to keep putting Americans in prison?
I've spoken with several family members of these Americans that have been released. One thing that they've been frustrated by for years was a lack of willingness to engage with the Maduro regime. The United States hasn't had diplomatic relations with Venezuela since 2019, something that really complicated these back-channel negotiations. So, you know, I think it's important to ensure that we're not incentivizing authoritarian governments around the globe to use Americans as bargaining chips. But, you know, I think on some level, you do need these kind of diplomatic exchanges to release Americans that are being held unjustly abroad.
Jeff, what about this whole story interests you the most?
It's really what we don't know. We know there's been this prisoner release, but it's happening in a context in which Venezuela is slated to hold presidential elections in the coming year. And there's a lot of open questions about what those elections could look like. The current opposition candidate, Maria Corina Machado, is banned from holding political office. And I think that's going to be the next hurdle in the Biden administration's policy towards Venezuela.
Jeff Ramsey is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He joined us from Manizales, Colombia. Jeff, thanks very much for your insight on all this.
Thanks for having me.
In Thailand, the parliament overwhelmingly voted to approve same-sex marriage today, redefining marriage as a union between any two people. Thai lawmakers are still working out the details, but the law is expected to go into effect in the coming months. This makes Thailand the first country in Southeast Asia to take this step. The country has a reputation for acceptance, but gender diversity is not always embraced. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports from Bangkok.
John Lennon's Imagine, as sung by the Bangkok Gay Men's Chorus. The a cappella group performed on the streets of Bangkok this week on the eve of an event that once seemed very hard to imagine.
30 years ago, I even think that being gay is wrong. So getting married to another man, definitely not in my whole wide world at the time.
Ponnawat Warit Nantakun is a 51-year-old vocalist with the Bangkok Gay Men's Chorus. By day, he runs a factory making cardboard boxes. In his free time, he sings with the dozen or so men in the chorus, performing in malls and schools. But being openly gay in public was once Ponnawat's worst nightmare. He was terrified his family would reject him.
If they knew, if they found out, it would be the end of the world for me.
Much has changed in Thailand in the past couple decades. On TV, some of the top soap operas feature two men falling in love. Transgender politicians have run for office and won. Thailand's tourism board urges LGBTQ couples to fly here and hold wedding ceremonies, blessed by Buddhist monks. But ceremonies are one thing. Only now is the government sanctioning same-sex couples getting legally married.
We have been trying to push this forward more than a decade, so we consider it is slow.
Rapipan Jomarung is a legal scholar with Mahidol University. He says most of Thai society has accepted same-sex relationships for a while now, but polls show one-third of Thais do oppose same-sex marriage. Activists have had to pressure conservative lawmakers to accept what they call equal marriage, not watered-down civil partnerships that give same-sex couples most marriage rights, but not all. Rapipan says the activists can finally claim victory.
Well, of course, they'll be thrilled. Equal marriage law is the final destination that we hope to achieve.
95% of Thais are Buddhist, from a tradition called Theravada Buddhism that does not condemn same-sex love. Any opposition will usually come from inside someone's family, says Ponnawat. He says conservative parents might fear it harms the family name. When Ponnawat finally came out to his mother as an adult, she worried, what will other people think?
It was a hard step for her to take. Yeah, it was a very, very bitter pill for her to take.
Ponnawat's mother did finally accept him. He thinks parents of his generation today are far more open. And he's proud of how far Thai society has come.
At least we have something good to talk about. We can actually say we are far advanced than other countries in the region.
In Southeast Asia, the Sultanate of Brunei has on its books laws punishing intimacy between men with stoning, though it's not enforced. Also in the region, Muslim-majority Indonesia, where nearly 90% of the population strongly opposes same-sex marriage, according to a recent Pew Center poll. In the Philippines, a majority Catholic country, the figure is 80%. And then there's Thailand, now the largest country in Asia to fully embrace LGBTQ marriage. It's a place, Ponnawat says, where he no longer has to fear being himself.
Every time we get up on stage, it's us telling people, here we are. Proud gay men doing something good for you guys.
For the world, I'm Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok.
Think of Jupiter as the big sibling to planet Earth. It could explain why 75% of the Earth's surface is covered by water.
We think that water came probably from comets and that those comets got shepherded to Earth by Jupiter.
These types of planetary sibling relationships exist elsewhere and could hold clues about life in other solar systems. Coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The quality of cancer care around the globe is dramatically unequal. In Peru, for example, cancer patients face a lack of doctors, medicine, and hospital beds. It's especially rough for children with leukemia. Many of them end up dying simply because they can't find treatment in time. More parents in Peru are seeking help for their children on the other side of the Atlantic in Spain. We have two reports coming up on this, beginning with the world's TBC Isaiah from the Peruvian capital, Lima.
Every single day for the past 6 months, Johnny Carrion visits his son Estefano at the Edgardo Rebagliati Hospital in Lima. Estefano is 16.
Hijito, ¿Cómo estás? ¿Cómo te sientes hoy día?
How are you, son? Carrión asks. I'm okay, Estefano says. They are from Pulcapa, a city in the Peruvian Amazon. 2 years ago, Estefano started having difficulties breathing and his skin turned pale. The local doctors weren't sure about what he had and recommended that he go to Lima, the capital, for a proper diagnosis. Once there, he got the bad news.
Mi hijo fue diagnosticado con leucemia linfoblástica aguda.
Estefano had leukemia.
Inmediatamente lo trasladamos acá a la ciudad de Lima.
And he needed to stay in Lima because it was the only place in Peru where his son could get treatment. Estefano and his family left their life in Pucallpa, but what they found in Lima was disappointing.
Cuando no hay medicinas, instrumentos médicos.
Hospitals had no medicines, no basic tools, no doctors, no beds, Johnny says. And there are waiting lists of up to 2 years for a bone marrow transplant. On top of that, parents like Johnny are forced to pay for the medicines needed for chemotherapy out of pocket. In Peru, around 1,800 kids are diagnosed with leukemia every year, and many face the same challenges as Estefano. His father, Johnny, joined an organization that supports parents of children with cancer. Karina Pujay is the founder. Her daughter was also diagnosed with leukemia when she was 6 years old.
Y han muerto 120 niños, y ella es la única viva.
Of all of the 120 kids that were hospitalized at the same time, my daughter is the only one who survived, Pujay says.
Entonces nos juntamos y emprendimos una larga pelea con el gobierno.
So we joined forces to demand solutions from the government, she says. They organized public demonstrations, fundraising campaigns, and started lobbying officials. In Peru, cancer patients are protected by law. They have the right to receive free treatment in public hospitals, and the government is supposed to pay to send them abroad if necessary care is not available at home. But the law is simply not enforced. Mauricio León is an oncologist with the League Against Cancer in Peru.
El cáncer infantil comparado con el cáncer de adultos tiene mucho mejor pronóstico, muchísimo.
He says, in general, child cancer has a very good prognosis and close to 90% of patients tend to do well. But in Peru, that's not the case. According to official data, the mortality rate for infant leukemia is 22%, among the highest in Latin America. These numbers are from 2017 and have not been updated since. Karina Pujoy says the situation is much worse now. Her organization has been independently verifying the number of kids with leukemia that die in hospitals in Lima. And she says the mortality rate is close to 60%. Dr. Mauricio León says part of the problem is a shortage of doctors.
No hay ahora el curso de oncología en la mayoría de universidades de medicina.
Few universities in Peru offer a medical degree in oncology, he says. Another problem is political instability in Peru. In the last 5 years, Peru has had 6 different presidents and 11 ministries of health.
La gente hace propuestas pues cortoplacistas porque su mandato dura poquito.
Public officials don't have a long-term plan and don't take responsibility for the problem, León says. Health officials didn't respond to multiple requests for comment. This past June, Johnny Carreón got more bad news. After his son Estefano finally got a bone marrow transplant, cancer re-emerged a few months later.
Me confirmaron mis sospechas. No habían hecho un...
The doctor confirmed my suspicion and told me there is nothing else we can do, he says. But Johnny refused to accept that as the final answer.
Busqué otras opciones, Hice contacto con un hospital de España, San Juan de Dios de Barcelona.
I looked for other options, he says, and found out that Spain is a common destination for cancer patients from Peru because they can get affordable and high-quality treatment there. Then he spoke with an oncologist in Barcelona who offered some hope. But first, Johnny needed to find the money to purchase plane tickets. So he sold a piece of land, the only thing he owned.
Pero cuando fui al aeropuerto a Jorge Chávez para...
But when we got to the airport, he says, immigration officials said we couldn't board the plane because there was a health order from the hospital banning my son from leaving the country. This will be the third Christmas that Johnny and his son Stefano spent at the hospital in Lima. But Johnny says it also will be the last one because he's determined to help his son survive cancer. And that means bringing him to Spain, no matter what. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isaiah, Lima, Peru.
And I'm Jerry Haddon in Barcelona. Many parents, like Johnny Carrion, do reach Spain with their sick kids. In fact, here in the northeast region of Catalonia, health authorities say one out of every four hospitalized child with cancer is Peruvian. The families usually arrive with little money and little more than the name of a hospital. No contacts, no papers, but they're desperate. This week, in a small dark apartment in a Barcelona suburb, one of those Peruvian moms coaxes her 11-year-old son out of bed. No name, she says, because they don't have residency papers and they're afraid of getting deported.
Hola, buenos días.
An exhausted little boy in pajamas comes into the living room, sits next to me on a couch. He's been suffering from leukemia for 3 years, just had another round of chemotherapy. He's bald, pale, his skin peeling from the treatment.
Estaba super mal. No, ni siquiera comía.
It was really terrible. At first, I couldn't eat because my mouth was filled with sores. I was tired and sleeping all day.
Una enfermedad que primero te ataca por cualquier lado.
This disease can attack you anywhere. Mine started with stomach pains. After that, they found out it was cancer.
That was in Lima. Doctors there said the boy needed a bone marrow transplant, but the waiting list was over 2 years. Too long in his case. His mom takes me outside to explain.
Entonces la doctora me dijo que no teníamos nada que hacer con mi hijo, que le dio una calidad de vida.
The doctor told me there is nothing more we can do. You need to just make sure your boy is comfortable. But how could I accept that as a mother? I started crying.
And then she says the doctor hugged her and whispered a word in her ear, Spain. Maybe, she said, they can save him in Spain.
No me hablaba como una doctora. Me hablaba como madre, por lo cual...
She didn't say it as a doctor, but as a mother. She could see how crushed I was, because it's not easy to hear that your son isn't going to make it.
The mom and her husband, a poor miner, sold everything, their tiny house, but it still wasn't enough for the plane tickets. Somehow, she got online influencers to take up her cause. She went on national TV, and it worked. People donated. In August, they landed in Barcelona on tourist visas. All they had was a photo of a children's hospital from Instagram. They took a taxi straight to the emergency room. The boy was sicker than ever, vomiting from his latest round of chemo. At first, the mom says, the hospital denied them care. You need to go back to Peru, they said. But a doctor saw the boy on the floor, and she intervened, had him admitted.
Ay, que fue mi ángel. Y por ella, mi hijo se ha entrado dentro.
She was my guardian angel. Because of her, my boy is in treatment.
The boy was in the hospital for weeks. His parents, lots of nights, they slept outside on the sidewalk. They had no money. Finally, last month, the boy got the bone marrow transplant that might save him. Healthcare authorities and pediatric oncologists declined to speak to the world for this story. It's a delicate subject. Usually, if you show up sick to an emergency room, you do get care in Spain, even if you don't have insurance. That policy is off the books, based on empathy but against the law. But the publicly funded healthcare system does have its limits, and cancer treatment is costly. Another Peruvian mom in Barcelona is up against those limits. She also came without papers to save her one-year-old baby who has ocular cancer. Meeting in a cafe, she tells me how she went to a hospital just after landing, but was denied care.
A social worker accused me of trying to sell my baby. Who's paying you? She asked. I told her, ma'am, how could I sell my own daughter, who's so sick?
They threatened her with deportation, she says. She also asks that I conceal her name. She says she's still hoping someone will help her baby and doesn't want to jeopardize that. For now, she and her baby are living in a Red Cross shelter, just waiting. But even if you do get your child into treatment, it doesn't mean you're out of the woods. The 11-year-old boy with leukemia, he's also waiting, on his couch, hoping he'll feel better.
I want to see my parents happy. I don't want them to suffer because of me.
But the bone marrow transplant, it hasn't entirely cured him of cancer, his mom tells me outside.
It should have disappeared with all those chemicals they gave him. They were so strong they burned his body. My boy's skin has practically turned into a hard shell.
Still, she says, she doesn't regret coming. At home, the only plan left was hospice care. Here, her boy still has a fighting chance. Her advice to other Peruvian families in the same boat? Risk it all. Come to Spain. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon in Barcelona.
Considering this show is The World, we are going way, way beyond our beat for this next story. We're talking about exoplanets and planetary sibling relationships and what all that has to do with figuring out if there's life in other parts of the Milky Way. Don't you fret about those terms. Lauren Weiss is with us to explain. She's an astrophysicist and professor at the University of Notre Dame and leads the team that's created the Kepler Giant Planet Search, the first ever catalog of small Earth-like planets with Jupiter-like siblings. First things first, Lauren, what makes Earth and Jupiter planetary siblings? What does that mean?
You know, we live here on Earth in the solar system, and our solar system has a very massive planet called Jupiter. It's about 5 times further out from the sun than the Earth is, but it's really massive. It's about 300 times as massive as Earth is. And that was really important back when our planet, all the planets in our solar system were just forming. Jupiter was able to move material, especially both rocky and icy material, to different places within the solar system in ways that the material would not have traveled in the absence of Jupiter. And one of the ways that's really important is Jupiter likely slingshotted the comets that bore water to Earth. Earth is actually an abnormally wet, rocky planet. Our rocky siblings, Mercury, Venus, and Mars, are all very dry in comparison. Whereas on Earth, of course, 75% of our surface is covered with ocean water. And we think that water came probably from comets and that those comets got shepherded to Earth by Jupiter.
Basically, you're saying Jupiter somehow slingshot water via comets to Earth?
Yes.
That's insane.
Yes, and not probably water, but possibly also amino acids or other materials that actually might have given rise to life. We don't yet understand what role Jupiter had in making life possible on Earth, but that's actually one of the things that this study I led is going to enable, is we now have lots of other planetary systems that we can study where there are both small planets like Earth and big planets like Jupiter. So we can study the dynamical relationships that these siblings have. Of course, the planets follow the laws of physics, but you could think about this at this holiday time as being a bit like families where, you know, you might have some sibling dynamics at home. And for the entire history of studying how planets interact with each other, we've only had one example, the solar system. Now we have this incredible sample of small Earth-like planets for which we actually know a bit more about what kind of siblings they have, and especially which of them have Jupiter-like siblings.
So we've got our solar system consisting of 8 planets, used to be 9, and we're in the Milky Way galaxy. So you've compiled a catalog of these planetary siblings outside our solar system. They're called exoplanets. What are they, and are there a lot of them out there in the Milky Way?
As of like 25 years ago, we knew of no planets outside of the solar system. In 1995, there was this major discovery, the first discovery of a planet orbiting a star that's not the sun. And that's what an exoplanet is. It's any planet that orbits a star that's not the sun. So they're just like the planets in our solar system, only they orbit other stars. And we now know of over 5,000 of these exoplanets. In the past couple of decades, that's how many we've found. And all kinds of planets exist that we don't have in our solar system, all sorts of exotic planets, that we don't have here, and also planets that are really common around other stars that we don't have here either. So we're just beginning to learn what kind of planets are common and what kind of planets are a bit less common. And this is so important because we're refiguring out the story of how planets form, including the story of how our own solar system and our own Earth formed.
Our solar system revolves obviously around the sun, which is a star, a fact that always blows my mind. So these exoplanets, are they also all gravitating around a star?
In general, exoplanets are planets that are orbiting other stars, and that's how we discover them, is based on the motions of their stars. But actually, an emerging finding in some of the research that others are doing is that you can have rogue exoplanets, planets that somehow got ejected from their planetary systems, probably by Jupiter-like planets, actually. You need a big bully to kick out a whole planet. So there are apparently some rogue planets out there, and actually a future NASA mission is going to be absolutely amazing at finding those rogue exoplanets.
Lauren Weiss is an astrophysicist at the University of Notre Dame. She leads a team that created the Kepler Giant Planet Search, the first ever catalog of small Earth-like planets with Jupiter-like siblings. And that is a big deal. Lauren, thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Young people in the United Kingdom have been moving away from organized religion in big numbers. That is not the case with Islam. It's one of the fastest growing religions in Britain. Around 4 million people in the UK currently identify as Muslim. According to some projections, that number is on track to grow to 13 million by 2050. Consider as well that the average age of British Muslims is young, just 27. All this week, reporter Rebecca Rossman has been bringing us stories about changing attitudes among young people across the UK around faith. In today's report, Rebecca sits down with two young British Muslims, one millennial and one Gen Z, for an open discussion about what it's like to be a practicing member of a faith that they constantly feel like they have to defend.
Founded in 1910, the East London Mosque is the oldest mosque in Britain. Originally, the mosque was made up of three houses down the street before it moved here on Whitechapel Road. Hundreds of people make their way into the building, which takes up nearly half a block for the afternoon call to prayer. Since its inception, the mosque has steadily expanded to accommodate more congregants.
So the footfall here is around 7,500 to 12,000 a day. So it is the busiest, probably the busiest mosque in the country.
That's Salman Farsi, the mosque's chief communications officer. Also with me in an upstairs room overlooking the main floor is 20-year-old congregant Hamza Ahmed.
This is the visitors' gallery. It overlooks the main prayer hall.
Ahmed is a proud Gen Zer. Farsi is a millennial in his mid-30s. Both are practicing Muslims of Bangladeshi heritage who were born and raised in London's East End. I wanted to hear more about what their religion brings to them and some of the challenges of being a Muslim in modern British society. Both had opinions which were, in many ways, shaped by the generation they grew up in.
For my generation in particular, I classify this as we're the war on terror generation.
Farsi was a teenager when two planes hit the World Trade Center on 9/11, which he says changed everything for Muslims all over the world.
We witnessed that awful tragedy, but then the press and the media pointed their cameras at us and at ordinary Muslims. And everything about us was scrutinized.
Growing up in that shadow became extremely difficult, he says. He found he was often constantly asked to apologize for acts of terrorism or explain why it had nothing to do with ordinary Muslims or the way Farsi sees Islam. Like the 7/7 London bombings in 2005, a series of coordinated suicide attacks on the London Tube carried out by Islamic terrorists, which killed 56 people and injured hundreds of others.
I mean, I found it extremely difficult to navigate and reconcile being a British citizen and Muslim, and, you know, which one do you give more precedence?
It's a question other religions aren't asked. Ultimately, Farsi says he and other Muslims of his generation settled on both.
there are values in being British and values from our faith that actually they're harmonious.
Farsi says it took a lot of self-reflection to get to that point, especially because it wasn't a question he ever felt he was being forced to reconcile with in the pre-9/11 era. Before that historic day, Farsi says the outside world wasn't pressuring him to pick sides or defend his religion. For Ahmed, who was born in 2003, things are different.
I grew up in the shadow, so you experienced a life before 9/11.
Yeah.
But I've never experienced that. So to me, it's always trying to show that I'm not associated with something that's a negative image of Islam. It's always trying to represent it in the best light, which is a lot to ask of a young person.
It's a lot to ask, but it also may be what makes both these men so eloquent and affirmed in their reflections.
You have to have a really clear sense of who you are, and you have to be able to defend your position and say, this is why I am.
This is Linda Woodhead, a professor of religious studies at King's College London, who I've been speaking to throughout this series on young people and religion in the UK.
Muslims, including young Muslims, can often give a very articulate account of why they're Muslim, but they're a minority. They have to. You know, they're often being, they have to defend themselves. A lot of it's Islamophobia, or they're just the people at school saying, why do you believe this?
I think there comes a time where you just have to draw a line in the sand and look, we need to become, this is who we are, this is our identity, this is our faith, and this is what we bring to the table, and we are part and parcel of British society.
Drawing that line in the sand remains a challenge, but both Farsi and Ahmed say it's their faith which is giving them the skills to be able to do that. When I ask Ahmed about the biggest thing Islam brings to his daily life, he has an immediate answer: confidence.
Because I know that my belief is that there's only one God, and he watches over all of our affairs. So I'm not really worried that something's not going to go a certain way, because I know that whatever's predestined for me is what's going to happen anyway.
For Farsi and his millennial generation, finding that confidence has become a bit more complicated, but he's working on it.
And I think that's the biggest thing, that we should just be confidently Muslim, and we should be able to be ourselves and practice our faith.
Without having to apologize for it. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman, London.
In the conclusion of our series on the UK's relationship with religion, we'll visit a church that is defying the national trend by attracting young people into the fold. Join us for that tomorrow. We close out the show today with our metronome set on 1-2-3-1-2. Defined by that 3-2 rhythm is merengue, the national sound of the Dominican Republic. The doyen of merengue in the DR is Manuela Josefa Cabrera Taveras, better known as Fifita La Grande. She's 80 years old now and continues to perform what's known as typical merengue, a more rural version of the sound. Merengue Típico relies on three main instruments which you can hear on this track: the tambora drum, the guira or scraper, and singer Fifita La Grande's specialty, the accordion. Fifita La Grande was 9 when she started entertaining at parties in her mountainous community of Santiago Rodriguez. She could do it all: accordion, tambora, and guira. This track, Caña Brava, is a classic in the merengue genre with an interesting history. It was composed in the 1920s as a promotional tune for a rum company, caña referring to sugarcane in Spanish, but endured over the years as a merengue standard. Fifita La Grande's older recordings, like this one, originally put out as a 45 single, are being re-released by Belgian record hunters and archivist Funky Bumpa as part of a new collection, Merengue Típico Nueva Generación. Keep those feet moving. The World comes to you every weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. We're online all the time at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening. We'll see you again tomorrow. Before we go, I want to remind you that we are nearing the end of our fall fundraiser. We have until December 31st, but we're still short of our goal. We won't get there without your help. Every gift will get us one step closer. Make your donation to support our human-centered reporting today at theworld.org/give. Thanks so much.
next.